But just reverting back for a moment, just to before we talk about what happened after 1971, going back to the history of Jacobs itself, I think an important factor here is that if you look at the history of Jacobs through the 20th century, it mirrors very much the history of Ireland.
What are the similarities?
Well, we can start at the beginning of the 20th century, in the early 1900s, when probably Jacobs was at its peak, so to say, in terms of size, influence, place in the world of biscuits, because it was a world player in the biscuit business, very much a world player. My understanding is that in the early years of the century, the Irish market, the sales of biscuits in the Republic of Ireland, in the island of Ireland, the Republic didn't exist then, but in the island of Ireland, were relatively small, maybe 10-15% of the total output. The other 85-90% was exported, mainly to Britain, but there's quite a large trade in cream crackers to Hong Kong, biscuit sales to the United States, and I think one of the older people once said, to be anywhere in the world where the map was red, there was a lot of red in the British Empire terms on the map, Jacobs biscuits were sold. Salesmen used to go out from Dublin and would be away for 6, 8, 9 months collecting orders, to bring them back, and then they used to have the photographs of them in the factory, of all these crates, Singapore, Hong Kong, Los Angeles, wherever.
Yeah.
But of course, the biggest single market was Britain, where they competed with Huntley and Palmer and with the company of Macfarlane Lang, the companies that later became McVitie's and so on. But that was the 1910s and 1912, 1913, that period, say. And then something happened, which was we all remember from our history books, the concept of Irish home rule, the idea of a political separation from Britain, whatever form it was going to take, began to emerge. I think this probably concerned the Jacob family. Now, at that stage, Jacobs, of course, were a partnership between the Jacobs and the Bewleys. I think that partnership, Jonathan would know more about this, but I think that my understanding was that partnership came around 1870 or so, when George Jacob was trying to develop new products, and quite specifically identified somewhere in the United States, I think, the biscuit we now know as the cream cracker.
Yeah.
And he developed that product, and of course it was a huge success. But it also, all his development activity, like so often happens nowadays, was costing money. And he needed capital. And he got that from the Bewleys. I mean, a trivial sum of money today, I think £2,000 or something, but a lot of money then. And the Bewley family brought with them more financial management skills, perhaps. The Jacobs were both production people. They were very skilled producers, manufacturers, engineers, and it seems very skilled marketeers at identifying foreign markets, identifying products for all those markets. They travelled a lot. There were people, I think my view looking back now would be, there were people with great foresight, great vision.
Did they see an opportunity to, with the material, the produce coming into the factory, did they see that, you know, there would be a knock-on effect, that they would be helping a lot? You know, you had Odlum's Mills supplying the flour.
Yeah.
I'm sure you had the wheat coming in as well.
Well, the wheat would have come from right across the world, mainly Canada, probably Ukraine, Hungary, pre-war,
Is that because it was more suitable?
More suitable, yeah. Biscuit manufacture requires a particular type of wheat, different wheat to bread manufacture. But and generally speaking, we always import the wheat. Now, it was milled in Ireland, of course, but likewise sugar, vegetable fats, so on, cocoa beans, obviously. These products would have been bought across them. So here's an interesting case, late 19th, early 20th century, of an Irish company buying products across the world, bringing them to Dublin, processing them, and then exporting them again. Why?
Yes, why?
Two factors, I think. Maybe three. Firstly, the Jacob family themselves, these wonderful entrepreneurs, these people of vision and determination. Secondly, of course, Dublin was part of the empire. Dublin was a major city within the British industrial world. And remember, that's at this stage now, the time we're talking about, British industry was at its peak. British industry was the primary producer in the world of all kinds of things. And thirdly, and most importantly, Dublin was a very cost-competitive city. Wages were low. And it was a place you could make things competitively.
But you said all of this would change at the time of coming up to the end of that century.
Yeah.
At the beginning of the
It's a reminder to us, I suppose, to certainly people like me, of how things do change. Sometime in the, as I said, well, say it's, if we take a point in time, 1910 to 1912, the Home Rule debate would have been gathering steam. And you're George Jacob sitting in your office in Bishop Street, thinking about the future, and you say to yourself, here, there's a risk. It was no more than a risk then, that Britain and Ireland could somehow or other move apart. And here I have this vast biscuit factory, one of the biggest biscuit plants in the world at that stage, apparently, sitting in Dublin, Ireland. Mm. My main market, maybe 50-60% of my output, is sold in Britain.
Yeah.
And meanwhile, anyway, I'm expanding and I need more manufacturing, I need more space. So maybe it might make sense to site a plant in Great Britain. And in fact, some of the directors, some Jacobs, some Bewleys, apparently went to Liverpool and identified a site at Aintree, not far from the racecourse, and they purchased a very large, I can't remember now how large, but I do remember it was a very large site they purchased, and started to build the biscuit factory there around 1915, 1916. Now, coincident with that, of course, there was the labour problems in Dublin in 1913, the Great Strike, and that must have
generated problems,
unrest, concern. You know, I'm sure management people of that day must have been quite concerned by the this is the first time they'd probably ever experienced organised labour disruption, certainly on that scale. And Jacobs were very involved. They were involved in the lockout, etc. Now, the Jacob family, like all Quaker families, were very good employers. To relative to the times they lived in, they certainly always provided well for their people. They were probably paternalistic. You know, there were good elements of that. I mean, they always provided very good medical facilities, for instance. Even when I joined the company first, I think we had our own factory doctors and that. We had a dentist, I remember, on site. And nurses, and at one time the company employed a number of professional school teachers.
And I think you had a swimming pool there as well.
That's right. That dates back to 19.
But that would suggest then that the doctor, the dentist, the swimming pool was to make. You could see that maybe they wanted to make sure that the employee wouldn't be on sick leave. That, you know, that.
Yes, yeah, yes. I think a lot of the paternalism. I think that's absolutely right, Morris. That
there's a thinking.
A lot of the paternalism was self. for your own benefit as much as the employer's benefit as much as, and it's very enlightened thinking in many respects.
Yes.
Instead of going off down the road to the dentist, here you can go upstairs to the dentist and it'll only take 20 minutes. But if you go off down the road, you'll be there 3 hours or something. Yeah. So it was
because you're working with
sensible, practical, yes,
of course, and because you were working with food,
yeah,
then you had to be clean, and
so you had, yes, and so that. But then, probably here in 1912, 1913, 1914, another factor entered into the employer-employee relationship, i.e. the trade union. Mm-hmm. Now the employee had divided loyalties. Certain loyalty to the employer, a certain loyalty to the trade union. Maybe, I don't know, but maybe as a consequence of that, Jacobs thereafter was a fairly highly unionised business. Most of our employees, in my time, most of our employees, vast, vast majority, were members of trade unions. But we'll come back to that.